It's perfect.
Perfect.
Okay, good evening. Welcome to the Jewish Theological Seminary and to the next in what have been really an exceptional series of book talks here at JTS this year, sponsored by the library. But, you know, the point is interesting Jewish books. And we've heard about some interesting ones in recent months, and we're going to hear about another one tonight. As you know, our speaker tonight, our author, is Jonathan Clowance. Jonathan was an undergraduate in the joint program, studying both at Columbia here and here in List College at JTS. I had the privilege of having him as a challenging student. Right? The challenging is only on account of the fact that if you've got excellent students, you've got to be sure to be very well prepared. And so, you know, it's nice when you have such students. I have to say that I commonly do. But Jonathan is one of those people whom I remember very well as having been a particular challenge and therefore a particular privilege. He did a master's at NYU and actually had the privilege of sharing a life's experience with me indirectly. That is to say, he did his PhD at Columbia. I did my PhD here at JTS. I'm David Kramer, director of the library, by the way. I didn't say that. But what we did share was our advisor for our PhDs, David Halivni, who is now in Israel and was an esteemed teacher and challenged us both to be the best scholars that we could be. Jonathan is now, as you know, a professor at Boston University. He has had a very distinguished career and will continue to have one. I mean, he's a very productive scholar. I can speak for myself and saying that I've learned a lot from his earlier books, including Impurity and Sin in Ancient Judaism, a very important book also on purity sacrifice in the temple, and in the book that he'll discuss tonight with the sources that he's distributed, he will take up theologies of ancient Judaism in Josephus. Before Jonathan begins, I just want to say two further things. The first is that we are privileged this evening to have in our company both the Chancellor of JTS, Professor Arnie Eisen. So, Arnie, thank you for being here. And our provost, Professor Alan Cooper. So now it's your challenge to do a good job. You can share my experience from the past. The other thing I want to say is that our custom is for the author to speak for about 40 minutes. You've got a source sheet, so we're going to be studying together. We're going to be learning together. But after the presentation, you will also have ample opportunity for questions, for comments, and so forth. And at the end, as you can see here, we've got a couple of piles of books. These are academic books. Right, so I say that because academic books are very expensive, but as academic books go, this is a genuine bargain, and you will have a real bargain this evening. This is for sale for what, $74, if you were to go to any of the online sources. But we have the ability to sell it to you this evening for $40. That also makes it easy for us to round off if you've got $20 bills, and the author for sure will be willing to sign the book for you, Professor Jonathan Clowance.
Thanks. So I sit, right?
You can sit, you can stand, however you're comfortable.
Sitting okay? Can you all see me? Should we do it that way? All right. So before anything else, I want to thank David Kramer for inviting me, Hector for making all of the arrangements, and all of you for coming out a week before Pesach, no less. Much of my learning took place in the classrooms in the library here at JTS, and that was when this tower was still a sealed-off disaster zone. And it's been a long time since I've been back here, and I'm really pleased and honored to be here. So thank you for inviting me. Thank you for having me. So my book in its title is perhaps unlikely for a Jewish scholar or at least a Jewish scholar of ancient Judaism. After all, it contains two words that make many Jews nervous or uncomfortable. Josephus is one, and theology is the other. The other words are fine, right? So the word theology certainly makes some people very nervous. Scholars of religious studies, that's where I hang out, they're often wary of theologians, worried, perhaps rightly in some cases, wrongly no doubt in others, lest contemporary religious studies departments become, or programs, be refashioned after the older Christian seminaries, from whence, of course, departments of religion emerged. Scholars of Judaism have a heightened anxiety with theology, one that has been understandably hardened by the clearly anti-Semitic descriptions of ancient Judaism, especially by certain influential European seminarians like Wellhausen or others. Now, to be sure, some important and influential scholars of ancient Judaism, Solomon Schechter among them, did attempt to counter these trends with systematic theologies of ancient Judaism. I'm thinking of Schechter's Aspects of Ancient Judaism. But these works have really fallen out of fashion. People don't write books like that anymore, or most people make fun of people who write books like that. Historically, at places like this one, scholars of Talmud and Jewish law reigned supreme, while theologians at that time struggled for respect. I've been asked many times, and mostly by Jewish scholars, why I use the T word in my work. And, well, one reason is this. My work seeks to counter, what we can call a law-centered approach to the study of ancient Judaism. Whether explaining disputes between Qumran and the rabbis, Jesus and other Jews, or even the Pharisees and the Sadducees, Jewish scholars of ancient Judaism, it's usually Jewish scholars of ancient Judaism in America and Israel, are very likely to call on matters of Jewish law as the one and the only cause of Jewish sectarian dispute between these ancient groups. Larry Schiffman's recent assessment and text 1A. Everyone have a text sheet? They're free.
Anyone else need?
All right. Well, don't take mine.
Okay, there you go.
Oh, there's a pile over there. Right? We have these. So text 1A, the law-centered approach to ancient Judaism. Right. This is in a number of ways quite typical. And if we just paraphrase, Jews argue about law and Christians argue about theology. And for those of you who remember Morton Smith, who used to walk these halls, the ones that were here 25 years ago. Morton Smith, his works are also frequently cited in support of this view as well. And underlined on text 1A, halachic issues are at the center of Jewish sectarianism in the Second Temple period. Now, a second common view about ancient Judaism, or about ancient Jewish theology, or about a lack of ancient Jewish theology, is also on my mind. And this perspective has also roots in this very building, as one key proponent of this view was Baruch Boxer, Zichrono Livracha, and this is in text 1b on the sheet in front of you, on page 1. And this view is rather prevalent, though, so Boxer's just sort of representative in this sense. And the view goes something like this. After the destruction of the temple, Jews were really unable to formulate any sound theological response. They were shocked to silence. Only after a great deal of time did the shock fade and did clear thinking or rabbinic Judaism emerge, right? And so in text 1b, right, the temple's destruction posed this traumatic crisis, and only later. Now, the common denominator here, the views are actually very complex. Actually, I'd rather talk more about what I'm doing than the foils, but the common denominator here is that for people to think these things, they have to believe that theology was not terribly important in the Second Temple period. Theological dispute, according to this view, had little to do with sectarianism, and theological discourse was not sufficiently sophisticated to withstand the challenge posed by historical catastrophe. Before the destruction, according to these views, Jews focused and argued about law. After the destruction, without sound theological discourse to draw on, Jews were thrust into a theological crisis, and, as Seth Schwartz says, for instance, that Judaism shattered. Now, my book is predicated on the following point. Approaches to ancient Judaism that downplay the significance or sophistication of Jewish theology of the Second Temple period face one insurmountable problem. Developed theologizing is central to the most important single source we have for the study of ancient Judaism, and that's the writings of Josephus. And when we look at Josephus, we find that he tells us that Jews argued about theology too. And when we attend carefully to what Josephus himself says, we learned that he had no difficulty responding to the destruction of the temple in theological terms, or incorporating the destruction within a theological schema. In other words, the two dominant trends that I've talked about so far are the law-centered approach and the theological crisis after 70 CE approach. Both involve overlooking or underusing Josephus. Now, why would this be? Well, if theology is one source of discomfort for many modern Jews, Josephus himself is another. So what about him? What about Josephus? Josephus was born approximately 37 CE into a priestly family. Briefly caught in the revolutionary fervor that raged in Galilee and Judea from 66 to 70, Josephus served briefly as a leader of the Jewish rebels in Galilee. Then, under circumstances that appear suspicious, to say the least, Josephus escaped alive from a suicide pact among doomed rebels and went over to the Roman side. He subsequently witnessed the Roman siege and destruction of Jerusalem from the Roman vantage point. He then settled in Rome, where he wrote in Greek four books that have survived, and these four books are listed in the text in front of you. We're going to skip text C for a minute, but you can see the four works of Josephus listed there. And now, even before we talk about these books, we need to explain this Jewish ambivalence about Josephus. That happens. Yeah, you got to listen to what I mean, although, that was a slip, but I don't know. Anyway, okay. Perhaps the main reason Jews are ambivalent about Josephus is the popular belief that he was a traitor. And in a matter of speaking, I suppose this charge is true. By his own account, which is, of course, the only account we have, Josephus early on gave up any hope that the Jews would hold out against the Romans, and he began to encourage his compatriots to surrender to Rome, and then he did himself. Josephus also claims that he accurately predicted that Vespasian would become the emperor. Now, I'll admit, Josephus went over to the Roman side. But I'm not sure this is treasonous or traitorous. If Josephus was a traitor, then so was the rabbinic hero of heroes, Yochanan ben Zakkai. At least according to the legends, ben Zakkai counseled accommodation with Rome. I'm not speaking historically, either about... Actually, we don't know what Josephus actually did. All we have is his story. We certainly don't know what Yochanan ben Zakkai did, but the stories are about the same. Right? According to the legends, ben Zakkai counseled accommodation with Rome, escaped from Jerusalem, predicted Vespasian's rise to the throne. If Josephus was a traitor, then why ben Zakkai? And forget ben Zakkai. If Josephus was a traitor, then why not Jeremiah? Jeremiah counseled surrender, and the biblical Daniel, whom we'll talk about in a minute, he spent time hobnobbing in the royal courts of Judea's oppressors. The Jewish tradition and populace has embraced its biblical and rabbinic naysayers as heroes, but rejected Josephus as a traitor, yet not for any objective distinction that I can discern. Josephus' first literary effort, Jewish War, was composed in the 70s. The work makes a number of points and tells a very complicated story. But one thing is clear. Josephus believed that the Roman destruction of the temple was God's punishment of the Jews for both rebelling against Rome and for hating each other enough to fight against themselves. In other words, Josephus pretty much takes the view that the later rabbis will take. The temple was destroyed to punish the people for their sins. This sentiment is stated repeatedly in the Jewish War, and you have two somewhat randomly selected passages in front of you. Now, in section 2, at the bottom of page 1, text 2a, Josephus goes and he catalogs, this is an extended passage that I've just excerpted, and he catalogs the various sins committed by the various rebel groups. And I'll skip the gory details, but he starts with one group and ends with the worst of the worst, which were the people at Masada. And accordingly, these each found their fitting end in the underlying passage, God awarding due retribution to them all. The defeat of these groups was because of their sinfulness. In fact, the very last substantial words of the book, of the whole book, prior to the colophon, and not talking about Jews in general, but just summarizing the end of the story in some ways, are these, text 2b. God, in his providence, the top of page 2. God, in his providence, inflicts punishment on the wicked. That is the last meaningful sentence of the book, and then he goes on and just says a few things about the book and, the colophon or sort of like the conclusion facts, right? But this is the last way he concludes the narrative. This is his summary. God, in his providence, inflicts punishment on the wicked. Now, if Jews were supposed to be shocked into silence after 70 CE, as some suppose, Josephus didn't get that memo, right? He didn't get the shock into silence memo. He's sitting there writing. whatever else they may be, Josephus's works constitute an early and thorough theological response to the destruction of the temple, and they merit our attention for that purpose. We may not like the response, but it's not much different than the traditional Jewish one enshrined in the liturgy, Mipnei Chataenu Galinu Me'artzenu, right? We were exiled from our land for our sins. 2 decades later, in 93 CE, Josephus completed his magnum opus, Antiquities, right, which is an account of Israelite and Judean history from creation to the first century CE. It's a 20-volume work, which, quite importantly, as we'll soon see, is set up in such a way to highlight the two destructions of the temple, 586 and 70 CE, as two pivotal events of Jewish history at his up until his day. Books 1 and 10 of the 20 books cover Genesis to Daniel. Books 11 through 20 cover the Second Temple period. And we'll conclude today by looking at how he discusses Daniel. Sometime later, Josephus wrote two more books, Life, something of an autobiography about Josephus's favorite subject, himself, and then Against Appian, which is a defense of Judaism against Roman detractors. If Josephus completed any other works before his death, which was probably around 100 CE, those books are no longer extant. As the centuries wore on, it was Christians who took the greatest interest in Josephus, studying his works and preserving whatever manuscript evidence now remains. Every manuscript we have is shaped by Christian hands. Christian scribes even made something of a Christian out of him, doctoring some passages in some manuscript traditions and perhaps adding a few passages in others. But for the most part, we can be thankful for these Christian efforts, for without them, we'd have nothing. And of course, it merits noting why Christians were interested in Josephus. Well, like other later rabbis, Christians too understood the destruction of the temple as divine punishment brought on the Jews. And Josephus was for them the prime recorder of this divinely ordained punishment. And handy for them, the Christians, Josephus wrote in Greek, in Rome, where his books could be read, picked up, and then preserved by Christian communities. And down to this day, the relative extent of Christian popular interest in Josephus is evidenced by the wide circulation of editions of Josephus' works distributed by Christian publishers such as Hendrickson, Kregel, and Thomas Nelson. These can be found in any bookstore. Do people still go to bookstores? Yeah, but they're there. I mean, I don't that often, but they're there. And they're not expensive. There is no similar mass-produced edition of Josephus's works addressed to any Jewish market, whether in Hebrew or English. There are editions of Josephus's works in Hebrew, but they're academic editions meant for, you know, well, for this audience, but not necessarily for the popular audience. I'm sure most of you have many Jewish books, but how many of you have copies of Josephus? It's a rhetorical question. Good. Wow, that doesn't count. All right. Now, my first book, my book, this one, the Josephus book, puts forward two interrelated hypotheses with regard to Josephus and ancient Judaism. The first hypothesis concerns Josephus' description of the Jewish schools of thought, the Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes. I argue that these brief accounts are reasonably accurate and should play a more central role in the understanding of ancient Jewish sectarian disputes. Jews cared about God, Jews argued about God. The second hypothesis concerns Josephus' own theological musings, which pepper all four of his literary works. I argue that this material, too, should figure more prominently in examinations of ancient Judaism in general, and the understanding of Jewish theological responses to the destruction of the temple in particular, where Josephus' works are largely overlooked when people talk about reactions to the destruction. Not entirely, but largely. Moreover, this evidence, Josephus' own theological musings, when properly understood, confirms Josephus' assertion concerning his Pharisaic allegiance. Josephus tells us he's a Pharisee, yet most scholars don't believe it. But, in my view, Josephus' works exhibit Pharisaic tendencies throughout, at least insofar as he understands Pharisaism. That is, he is a Pharisee by his terms. The body of the book consists of four chapters, each one reevaluating Josephus' approach to a key theological problem. Chapter 2 of the book, which is what we'll talk about the most today, treats the fate and free will debate. Chapter 3 in the book focuses on immortality and resurrection, and therefore deals with the Masada story, because the figure there gives this speech about resurrection, immortality, I should say. Chapter 4 treats Josephus' approach to law, tradition, and custom, not laws, but to his ideology of law, like when law can change and why. Chapter 5 treats Josephus' theological response to the destruction of the temple. Now, what we're going to do now is take a look at samples of Josephus' theologizing and see what we can learn about it, about Josephus, about the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes, about ancient Judaism, and actually perhaps also about ourselves and our assumptions. The bulk of my examples are going to come from Chapter 2 on the Fate Free Will debate, but at each opportunity that presents itself, I'm going to bring in materials from the post-destruction chapter, Chapter 5, as well. All right, so let's take a look about Josephus on fate and free will in ancient Judaism. So we're in section 3 on page 2 of the handout, Josephus on the fate, free will debate. And I want to take a look at Josephus' general statement about the problem, antiquities. And this is text 3a. And this one I think we need to read. The first sentence: at this time, there were three schools of thought among the Jews, which held different opinions concerning human affairs, the first being the Pharisees, the second the Sadducees, and the third that of the Essenes. By the way, this is astounding. He says this two more times as well, right? For Josephus, all three groups are there. All three groups represent legitimate approaches to Jewish philosophy or Jewish thought. He tells us repeatedly, right, that Jewish thought on these things is a vigorous, unsettled debate, a polydoxy. That's not my word, and I don't use it in the book, but the word is a bit apt. Now, as for the Pharisees, they say that certain events are the work of fate, but not all. As to other events, it depends on ourselves whether they take place or not. The sect of the Essenes declares that fate is the mistress of all things, and that nothing befalls men unless in accordance with her decree. The Sadducees do away with fate, holding there is no such thing, and that human actions are not achieved in accordance with her decree, but that all things lie within our own power, so that we ourselves are responsible for our well-being while we suffer misfortune through our own thoughtlessness. I'm sorry, I realize I didn't... all the translations from Josephus are coming from the Loeb Classical Library, modified at times, and I should have put that on this sheet. I'm sorry about that. Now we see, right, the problem, which Josephus well understands. This is what philosophers call and still call the free will problem. And the problem, which Josephus perfectly understands, is this: if things are established in advance, then human freedom is limited. The more they are planned, the less freedom we have. We see, by the way, also why the T word is appropriate. This is not just Josephus caring about his beliefs, but this reflects his interest. He really understands, takes time to figure out how these systems work. Now, I've laid out a chart here so we can sort of get this straight. It's a little confusing without it, but there are three groups, right? You've got fate and free choice, right? And free choice is this, your ability to control something, to do something or not do it, right? And fate, for now, is this overarching controlling force, determinism, right? If everything is planned in advance, then there is no free will. And that's what the Essenes believe, according to Josephus. If fate has no power at all, everything that happens is completely up to us. That, according to Josephus, is what the Sadducees believe. The Pharisees, they're kind of on the fence here, right? Some fate, some free will. All right? Now we ask, did Jews really argue about these things? Or has Josephus imposed a Greek philosophical dispute into a context where it means nothing? Now there's no doubt in my mind that Josephus is using terms that many Jews would not have used, or even have understood. But the concepts, I would argue, are ones that Jews knew about and argued about quite well. Josephus' statement about the Essenes' belief regarding fate are brief and rather clear, right? They believe that fate is the mistress of all things, and nothing comes about unless it's in accordance with her decree. Now, before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we actually would have had some difficulty identifying among our otherwise extant passages anything that clearly articulates something that really fully approaches determinism. But once we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's pretty clear that we have... This is, I think, the kind of determinism that Josephus is talking about. And notice what he says. We're now on page 2, text 3, right, rule of the community, text C, right there at the top. From the God of knowledge, not top, at the top of the text, so text 3C, bottom of page 2. From the God of knowledge comes all that is and shall be. Before they ever existed, he established the whole design. And when, as ordained for them, they came into being, it's in accordance with his glorious design that they accomplished their task without change. right? The laws of all things are in his hand, and he provides them with all their needs, right? And then two spirits, a spirit born of truth and a spirit of wickedness, right? And the spirits then control everything, right? Everything, Josephus describes the Essene position, right? Josephus says the Essenes believe in the predetermination of all events, apparently to the exclusion of human freedom. The Dead Sea sectarians, it appears, right, believed pretty much the same thing. But I'm not, it doesn't matter for our purposes whether they're the same people, right? Just that they're believing some of the same things. The wicked, if we take a look, turn to text D on page 3. In the mystery of his understanding and the glorious wisdom, God has ordained an end for injustice. At the time of visitation, he will destroy it forever. So wickedness is part of God's plan, and that wickedness will be destroyed at the end. But the wickedness now is part of the divine plan. So the wicked play their mysteriously necessary role, compelled by the powers of darkness, as they are predestined to do by God from the beginning. Now, for our purposes, to be clear, it doesn't matter whether the Dead Sea Scrolls can be identified with Josephus' Essenes 100%, or whether it's some of the Essenes, an offshoot of the Essenes. That question is irrelevant. All that matters for us right now, or for my purposes, is that the Dead Sea Scrolls provide us an initial confirmation that Josephus isn't making this up. Some Jews really thought these things, right? They really did believe that everything, including human evil, is part of a foreordained divine plan. And if this isn't evidence of Jews believing that all things were fated, I don't know what else could be. Now, as for the Sadducees, now there is no Sadducean literature at all, right? I mean, some people will say that the Dead Sea Scrolls are Essenes. We don't need to enter that as far as I'm concerned. There certainly is no verifiable Sadducean literature. Nevertheless, the Sadducean position on free will finds a striking precedent in the wisdom of Ben Sira, a book in the Apocrypha, and believed to have been composed in Jerusalem in the 2nd century BC. I'm not saying Ben Sira is Sadducean. I'm finding in Ben Sira, though, evidence that some Jews believe what Josephus says the Sadducees believe. And if we take a look at text page 3, text E on page 3, Ben Sira says, "Say not it was God's doing that I sinned, for what he hates, he, that's God, does not do. Say not it was God who led me astray, for God has no need of the sinful. Abominable wickedness the Lord hates. He does not let it befall those who fear him. However, it was God from the first. He created humankind and made them subject to their inclination. If you choose, you can keep the commandment." Right? Nothing is predestined. God is removed from evil, and people have human choice. Now take a close look at verse 11. "Do not say God." Now, that's interesting. Who would say such a thing? Well, maybe no one would say it in quite that way, but Ben Sira is imagining that some Jews would say that God made me sin, or God would, or some Jews would say evil is part of God's plan. And if evil, everything is part of God's plan, then evil is part of God's plan, and if I just sinned, well, that must have been part of God's plan too. Well, for Ben Sira, no. He, rather, affirms, especially in verses 14 to 17 there, a belief in freedom of choice. And why does he believe in freedom of choice? Because God is opposed to and has nothing to do with evil. Evil comes about as a result of human choice. It's not part of God's plan. And Ben Sira is here arguing with someone. He knows just what Josephus knows, that more than one approach is being taken at this time among ancient Jews. And in Ben Sira we find, first, the belief in freedom of choice. Second, the denial that anyone could be destined to evil. Because, and this is the third point, because God is opposed to evil. God is not the author of evil. Now, if we take a close look at another Josephine description of the Sadducees, the parallels will deepen. This is on page 3, text F, just going in order. The Sadducees, the second of order, do away with fate altogether and remove God beyond not merely the commission, but the very sight of evil. They maintain that man has the free choice of good or evil, and that it rests with each man's will, whether he follows the one or the other. Josephus' summary of Sadducean rejection of fate captures the essence of the same theological problem that vexed Ben Sira. If God makes people do evil, then God is implicated in evil. And then how can God be good? If both Ben Sira and Josephus is Sag, for both Ben Sira and Josephus is Sadducees, the answer is this. Humans are free, and God is therefore innocent of human evil. Again, this is ancient Jewish theology at work. Finally, a brief word about the Pharisees. Actually, I shouldn't have said finally. Finally for this section, right? A brief word about the Pharisees. That was a teaser. Of course, we cannot verify the view that Josephus attributes to them directly because we don't have Pharisaic literature. But we confirm that various Jews thought this way, both before and after the destruction. From before the destruction, there's Tobit, also from the Apocrypha, chapter 6, verse 18. This is text G, which contains the earliest Jewish reference to the notion of a bashert. Obviously, not using that word. I don't know why. Right? But the concept, again, is there, right? So Josephus used Greek, but and should have used Hebrew. Tobit should have used Yiddish, whatever. Okay. So, that one's, but what is this notion? That one's destined partner is established in advance. Now, in the book of Tobit, the woman in question has had to endure a series of marriages, all resulting in dead husbands, right? She's had seven husbands die on her, right? That it's a comedy, Tobit. Never mind. all right. Not for them, I guess. Anyway, but that's how comedy works, right? The extraneous characters, it's not funny for them. Okay. Now, but then she finds her Bashert. Now, but Bashert, this notion of a Bashert is a partial determinism, right? Some things are fated, all things, other things just happen. Notice this. One of the things about this notion of the Bashert that I teach it purposely in these contexts is because most of us are, when we get into this, or most audiences, I should say, we have this libertarian bent. We don't want to think God controls anything. We want to think we're completely, that our moral decisions are completely unfettered. But then every once in a while we get in these moods and you sort of want to think that there's something providential in finding that partner, right? So, that's partial determinism, right? If you think God controls that but not something else, that's partial determinism. That's what the Pharisees believed according to Josephus. Now, there are other parallels, many parallels in rabbinic literature. There are also statements in rabbinic literature that aren't quite parallel to this. I'm not saying that all rabbinic literature can be put into this, but a fair number of statements within rabbinic literature can, or extended passages can. But to take out a pithy one, Hakol Bidei Shemayim Chutz Meirat Shemayim, that's text H, right? Everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven. Right, and that's a sort of embracing this paradox, right? A partial determinism, some balance between fate and free will. So far, we've seen that Josephus's discussion of the fate and free will debate is relatively verifiable. We can find texts that agree with each of the views he's adduced. Josephus's Essenes agree with the scrolls, the Pharisees agree with the earlier Tobit and the later rabbis, and the Sadducees agree with Ben Sira. Right? Without equating these groups, these various things agree. Moreover, sources like Ben Sira in particular confirm what Josephus too tells us. Not only was there a disagreement, there was debate, an acknowledged disagreement, right, on things concerning God and the good. This, as I've said, is what we can call ancient Jewish theology. The T word at work indeed. Now, the next thing I'd like to do, to turn to page 4, and then we'll go back to one or two texts that we skipped. The next text I'd like to look at is one that you've likely not encountered. Some of you may well have seen a number of these texts before. I'm guessing, though I don't want to push it, right, because some of you actually own Josephus, which surprises me, but okay, that's great, right? But I'm guessing most of you haven't seen this passage before, but maybe some of you have. This passage comes precisely halfway through Josephus' Antiquities, the end of Book 10, right? So this is after he's described the destruction of the first temple. Now, this matters because Josephus, the whole structure of Antiquities is set up like he gets it. The destruction of the second temple is the replay of the first story, right? Take two, right? Second act, right? We should not be surprised that Josephus speaks so highly of Daniel. Makes a great deal of sense to suppose, as many others have pointed out already, that Josephus actually sees himself as something of a latter-day Daniel. Like his predecessor, Josephus too was a wealthy Jewish exile in a foreign capital, one who had mastered local languages and had access to imperial rulers. But Josephus's praise of Daniel goes further. Josephus is particularly taken by Daniel's seemingly unique ability to predict not only what will happen, but when it will happen. So text 4A, right by 267, right? Daniel wrote various books, but he was not only wont to prophesy future things, but, right, he, where's underline, also fixed the time at which these would come. Now, not only that, right? But the passage then continues to suggest that Daniel's precise predictions included information even about Rome. 276, the next passage, 4b. These misfortunes, the ones predicted by Daniel, our nation did in fact come to experience under Antiochus Epiphanes. Right? Remember, we learn in at JTS or wherever, when we learn about Daniel, we learn that Daniel was written in the Maccabean period, or at least the latter part of it. Right? But Josephus didn't know that. Right? He bought it hook, line, and sinker. He thought it was predicting, right, the Maccabean. He buys it hook, line, and sinker. Right? Just as Daniel, many years before, saw and wrote that they would happen. In the same manner, Daniel also wrote about the empire of the Romans, and that Jerusalem would be taken by them, and the temple perhaps, or Jerusalem, or whatever would be laid waste by. There's a text problem here, but it's very clear that he mentions the Romans in connection to Daniel. And that is, Josephus believed, just like the later rabbis did, that Daniel, that Rome is Daniel's fourth kingdom, right, in the sequence of kingdoms. If you know Daniel, you can plug that in. If not, it doesn't matter. But the idea that Josephus believed that Daniel predicted Rome. Now, this is very important for appreciating Josephus' self-understanding and the way he addressed his multiple audiences. Now, Romans would be impressed at this point by the precise predictions contained in Jewish oracles, and perhaps be impressed by Josephus' suggestion that the Jewish God predicted the rise of Rome. But Jewish readers, and I'm certain Josephus intended his works to be read by Jews as well, Jewish readers would be able to fill in an important blank. If Daniel predicted the rise of Rome, as Josephus mentions, then what? Then Daniel predicted the fall of Rome, which he doesn't mention. Because in the book of Daniel, it's not the foreign kings who get the last laugh. In the book of Daniel, what goes up comes down. Right? Josephus' retelling of the time between Nebuchadnezzar and Ezra in Book 10 of Antiquities is extremely important for appreciating the fact that Josephus did not believe that his world ended in 70 CE, any more than the Israelite world ended in 586. For all the talk of 70 CE as some unexpected disaster, it's important to keep in mind something that Josephus never forgot. The temple had been destroyed once before, and the destruction had been survived once before. Right, this whole notion of the destruction of the Second Temple is unprecedented. It makes absolutely no sense. It is, by the way, an imposition of post-Holocaust thought onto this, right? Where everybody's thinking about unprecedented catastrophe in the back of their mind. But for Second Temple Jews, makes absolutely no sense at all. The destruction of the Second Temple is completely precedented. It was the destruction of the Second Temple. So, in the aftermath of 586, Jews somehow managed to atone for themselves for their sins without a temple and returned to build a new one. Perhaps Daniel pointed in the direction of the future. Prophets, like Daniel, pointed in the direction of the future for Josephus. And this realization didn't take generations. It's right there in Josephus' writings right after 70 CE. If Josephus was experiencing some theological crisis, whatever solutions we can eventually discern are already there in Josephus. Josephus' discussion of Daniel is also important for other reasons, though. And this is in 277. All these things... Right, 277, all these things, as God revealed to them, he left behind in his writings. Right, so the fact that Daniel predicted these things, and what do we learn? We learn from this, what's underlined, how mistaken are the Epicureans who exclude providence from human life and refuse to believe that God governs its affairs, or that the universe is directed by a blessed and immortal being to the end that the whole of it may endure. They say that the world runs by its own movement, automatically, without a knowing guide or anyone else's care. But if it were leaderless in this fashion, it would just crash and burn, right? All right? But it therefore seems to me, 280, right, in view of the things we're told by Daniel, that they are very far from holding a true opinion, who declare that God has no thought for human affairs, right? God is the pilot who rightly guides the ship. Now, as we read this passage, we need to ask two questions. First, what kind of view is Josephus taking here? Right? How does it fit? Is Pharisee, Sadducee, Essene? What does he assert to be the truth about divine plans and God? And second, who are these Epicureans? And which view is he rejecting outright as unacceptable? As for Josephus's view, Josephus here reveres Daniel because he was able to make precise predictions. This proves for Josephus that the world is rightly guided by an active pilot who can account for the world in real time. But Josephus is certainly not articulating a view that we would attribute to the Essenes. Right? Josephus knows what fate is, and he doesn't use that word here. He uses the word providence, and we'll distinguish them in a minute. And note, if everything were fated by God in advance, then every prophecy would look just like Daniel's. Prophecy is exceptional. Daniel's prophecy isn't exceptional. Some things could be predicted that way. And this teaches two things. One, that God can and surely will bring about a set plan if he has one, right? So just like the ship can bring the destiny, right? The ship knows where it's going. Right, the pilot of the ship has a destination, is going to get there. But that doesn't mean, right, you know exactly how the winds are going to blow or exactly which precise place you're going to be along that route. Right? So it is equally the case that the world's plan is not entirely or precisely mapped out in advance. Most events are not set in stone ahead of time, just as most prophecies, even if they come true, will be vaguer and less precise than the exceptional prophecies of Daniel. Josephus here articulates a perspective that rejects rigid determinism as much as it rejects Epicureanism. Josephus's view is in the middle, just like the Pharisees in Antiquities 13. Some things are set in advance, but other things are not. Everything, though, happens under God's watchful eye. And that's the difference between providence and fate. Providence is God's watchful eye, acting in real time, right? Making sure things will work out right in the end, but not controlling everything, guiding the ship, right? So for Josephus, it's providence always, fate sometimes. Providence always, fate sometimes. Now, this is a view that allows one to understand historical events, including historical catastrophe, as commensurate with divine providence. Prophetically foretold catastrophes don't question divine providence. They prove it. Like, this view doesn't remove God from evil. Just allows some things to be free, but not necessarily everything. So this passage is not just some abstraction on Greek philosophy. The passage is part and parcel of Josephus' response to the destruction. The events of Josephus' own day were predicted by God, who governs the world justly. Earthly catastrophe can be divinely ordained earthly punishment, especially when fulfillment of prophecy. Neither faith nor the covenant is shattered after 70 CE, both fully in force and easily assimilable to traditional Jewish texts. Now, so far, I've argued that Josephus' accounts of the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes are meaningful and confirmable. And so far, we've also seen that Josephus' view aligns most closely with the Pharisees as he describes them, as well as later rabbinic sources. But I want to ask now, who are these Epicureans that he condemns? What's up with them? And are they the Sadducees? Which is what most scholars think. Before going further, I want to say something about the Sadducees, because that's something we don't do as often. I've mentioned two of my book's foils. Right, but there's actually a third, so we need to go back to page one. Sorry about the way this is set up, right? But we can see two foils already about the Schiffman view about law-centered, the Boxer view about traumatic crisis, and then there's this despising the Sadducees. Everybody hates the Sadducees. And I've picked on Finkelstein, or I've selected Finkelstein, I should say, again, just picking the resonance for here. But Finkelstein is not distinctive in respect. Finkelstein is representative of an A to Z of Jewish scholars. Actually, I don't have an A, but Baron, Geiger, Lauterbach, Zeitlin. I mean, you could fill in the whole thing. All made a habit of denigrating the Sadducees in favor of the Pharisees. The Sadducees are derided as blind literalists by Lauterbach, repeatedly. Or self-serving materialists by Finkelstein. Why this disdain for the Sadducees? Well, Protestant dislike for priests and temples is certainly one reason. And even scholars like Schechter and Finkelstein, who rejected the extremities of Protestant anti-ritualism, they were still inevitably influenced by it to a great degree. right? This Protestant rhetoric infects everything that's happening at that time. A middle class disdain for and jealousy of aristocratic wealth is no doubt also true, right? If you have a rich enemy, pick him, right? If you're picking of that. That sometimes happens in academia. But a third may be the most important. Scholars like Schechter, Finkelstein, and the rest, and Lauterbach, were struggling to defend Pharisaic and rabbinic Judaism against anti-Semitism. And in this context, the Sadducees made a worthy and useful scapegoat. You know, there were first century Jews who, money-grubbing, rich, self-serving, materialistic, worthy of disdain and criticism. Those are the Sadducees, and they're long gone. Jesus could have been right about them. It's handy to pass things off on the Sadducees because no one claims to be descended from them. No one is descended. No one complains. Right? Perfect. No, not perfect. Our job as historians is not to condemn our ancestors' opponents to the dust heap of history just because they lost. That's not history. That's advocacy. I believe that scholars of ancient Judaism have largely been asleep on the job when it comes to the Sadducees. Our job is to try to understand what the Sadducees were about. Now, actually, Josephus hates the Sadducees too, but at least he gives them enough of the benefit of the doubt to make a good sense of their theology. And we could also do so if we read Josephus carefully. If we look back at page 3, text F, right? Right by 164, right? We looked at this once, right? We see when the Sadducean approach, the fate-free will problem is directly connected to the question of whether God can be implicated in evil. After all, if the world is following a prefixed plan, if all things are fated, and then if terrible things happen, then those terrible things must be part of the divine plan. The Sadducees oppose this. Their God is removed from evil. In their world, evil comes about as a result of human free will. God is the author of good. He removes himself from the sight of evil. Perhaps we should say that God hides his face. Right? Just as the Deuteronomic tradition predicts. Right? Hester Panim, text I at the bottom of that page. Now, we'll understand more fully the issues at stake. This is our last flipping. If we turn back finally to page 4 and look at Antiquities 276, and we remind ourselves, 10-276, we remind ourselves that Josephus believes that Daniel predicted the Maccabean conflict, including the Antiochene persecution of the Jews. This means that these terrible things were part of God's plan from the beginning. What would the Sadducees say? No way. God doesn't plan evil in advance. Nothing is fated. There is no pre-planned evil. These events were not brought about by a divine plan. They happen, rather, because of the people's free will, which causes God's countenance to turn away from the people, causing more free will to let hell break loose. Now, to step into the present for a moment, I want to suggest that the contemporary Jewish disdain for the Sadducees is really strange, considering the fact that the free will defense, as well as the notion of God's hiding his face, play prominent roles in modern Jewish attempts at explaining contemporary catastrophe, namely post-Holocaust thought. The strongest, clearest precedents for these strains of post-Holocaust thought in ancient Jewish literature can be found, in my view, in Josephus's account of the Sadducees. The Sadducees believed that earthly evil resulted not from any divine plan, but from free will. And when the world got really bad, God refused to look. He closed his eyes, or we could say, he hid his face. A great deal of my book is about giving credit where credit is due, both to Josephus and to the Sadducees. Many modern Jews owe more to the ancient Sadducees than we are aware. The common disdain for them is, I believe, unwarranted. Enough with our problems, though. Let's go back to Josephus, where we now see that we're left with a question. If we recall Josephus's rejection of the Epicureans, we might think that Josephus is setting us up to associate the Sadducees with the Epicureans. And indeed, this is the implication as drawn out by a number of scholars, but I think it's mistaken. And this allows us to return to an important distinction. I develop it further in my book, and I mentioned it briefly, and it's one that's key for understanding what Josephus is and is not saying about Jewish theology and the Sadducees and Epicureans. And that's this distinction between fate and providence. Fate is the belief that everything is planned in advance. Providence is the belief that the world is rightly guided. Some things may be planned, but others result from real-time decisions by God. In Antiquities 10, Josephus explains his view. Providence is constant, fate is partial. Some things are set in advance, other things are not. All things, however, are rightly guided. In Antiquities 13, we learn that Josephus' view that fate is partial is the Pharisaic view. The Essenes, we are told, believe that everything is fated, and the Sadducees believe that nothing is fated. But the Sadducees, in Josephus' view, don't deny divine providence. Indeed, they believe in God and refuse to associate God with any form of evil at all. That's why their God removes himself from the sight of evil. They would rather limit God's power in order to preserve his providence in the purest sense. Right? So that God's providence can only be involved in the good. So the terminological distinctions here matter. The Sadducean denial of fate is not equal to the Epicurean denial of providence. Epicureans deny providence, deny God. Sadducees deny fate. And the difference is this. Epicureans really are atheists. Josephus' Sadducees are not. Now, rude and boorish they might be. He doesn't like them with their wealth or whatever, right? But fine, right? But they're not atheists, not any more than most modern Jews. Indeed, probably most modern Jews whose belief in divine providence forces them to remove God's hands and eyes from the catastrophes of the last century. So actually, I have no idea who Josephus' Epicureans are unless they're the Epicureans in Rome, right? It's actually quite possible that Josephus is saying what he means. Could always be. All right. Conclusion. Josephus and Jewish theology. I hope the general theses of my book are clear. Theology was, in fact, important to ancient Judaism, and Josephus' writings are more important in this respect than generally acknowledged. I want to say a few things that I'm not saying, just to be clear. I'm not arguing that Josephus is a reliable historian, perfectly. Josephus made mistakes. He fabricated things. He used sources without acknowledging them, like all historians did back then. My book is not an apologia for Josephus as a reliable historian across the board. I'm not saying the Masada story happened. I'm not saying Josephus tells us the truth about himself. I do believe that Josephus' evidence about Jewish theology has, though, been unduly, perhaps unfairly, dismissed. That's the baby, that, at least, that should not be thrown out with the bathwater, which is a terrible expression. I'm sorry I used it. But we should do well to pay more attention to Josephus. I do not, so that's one thing I'm not arguing, right? That not that Josephus is right about everything, but if we can verify it as we can here, then we take it seriously. I also do not argue that Jews argued only about theology. I've written two books about purity and the temple, and far be it from me to say these things were irrelevant. We cannot replace the law-centered approach with a theology-centered one. Rather, we must simply acknowledge that religious disputes are likely always about both praxis and belief. And at least as far as ancient Judaism is concerned, theology mattered too. Finally, I want to be very clear, I am not arguing that the destruction of the temple was no big deal. The destruction of the Second Temple was trauma, and it was a game changer. And Jewish society was challenged and changed. Judaism, however, did not shatter. Judaism was not shocked into silence, and the Jews of Josephus' day were not lacking in the theological sophistication to get their heads around what happened and to figure out how they could still believe in God or atone for their sins. Josephus helps us understand that Jews quickly realized that the destruction of the Second Temple could be compared to the first and explained in much the same way. Not as evidence that God's covenant was over or that his providence was lacking. The covenant is in force, God is in control, and Jews are being punished. That's what Josephus says. That's what the rabbis say. But of course, there were some variables. Determinists could see 70 CE as part of God's mysterious plan and leave it at that. Sadducees might have believed that the destruction occurred as God hid his face, right? The what happened in the aftermath of God's removal of his providence temporarily. Pharisees, like Josephus, would simply accept that earthly evil can be at times a manifestation of divine punishment. That's all over rabbinic literature, and it's what Josephus says of the Pharisees. Many modern Jews don't want to acknowledge it quite that way, but I think it parses out this way, that much modern theology is actually more Sadducean than Pharisaic. After all, the providential God of a just world, now just explaining the Pharisaic view, right, from the Pharisaic and from the rabbinic point of view, the providential God of a just world must punish people who deserve punishment and must actively bring it about. Centuries later, the rabbinic response wasn't all that different. Josephus paved the way. And, whether we like his answer or not, we should give Josephus more credit for doing so. Thanks. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely, I can take questions, yeah.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm just curious, the sources that you've drawn on for this sheet, at least, are drawn from both Antiquities and the Jewish War, but you haven't drawn any from Josephus's other two works, and I'm curious whether you see theological elements in those as well, and if they accord with the picture you've painted here.
Yeah, I could still be talking, and I would have brought in a passage from Appian, which I cut, because I knew it wouldn't fit. I think I went over a little bit, but I think we're all still here, so that's good. So Appian, very theological. Toward the second, you know, there are a number of key passages there. In particular, in Appian, there's one passage, which is the one I would have brought in, where he says, sort of, it's the wrapper-up of this. He says, all Jews believe in providence. All Jews believe in divine providence, which many people, right, what people have usually done with that passage is say, aha, see, he really thinks the Sadducees are heretics, because they're equating providence and fate, right, which some Greek philosophers do, but I don't think Greek is, but not all of them. Lots of people differentiate providence and fate, and I think Josephus does as well. Life is an autobiography. You're not going to get a lot of theological stuff there. There's some interesting stuff there, but not, you know, it's really, it reads a lot like an itinerary of the different things he was doing primarily through the war. But it is in life that he identifies himself as a Pharisee. So the first, so for people like me, like the first 15 lines of life matter, the last 30 lines of life matter, and then we get pretty bored in the middle there, right? I mean, unless you're interested in the sequence of events of the war, right? I mean, there are little comments in there in life. Appian, more important, but really it is Antiquities and Jewish War that pertain for this. Appian is very important in Book 4, in the Jewish, in the Halakha chapter of my book, because Appian covers a lot of Halakha there. And he also, Josephus talks there about consensus, which I think is, you know, that's sort of how, there's actually a footnote in my book about this. You know, Josephus is almost like an early proto-Schechter, right? He actually believed, like, when everybody agrees the law can change, then the law changes, right? But the law changes by consensus. This shouldn't surprise us. I mean, this is an official view of Islam, right? So it's not like Schechter invented it either, right? And that comes out of Appian. Was there in the red, and then, yeah?
You mentioned that Josephus sort of paved the way theologically for the rabbis at the very end of your talk.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, to what extent did medieval Jewish thinkers who actually explicitly address some of these theological issues read Josephus, as in, like, Maimonides and Shmuel Prakim offers a compatible
right.
account of the free
That's
modernism
right.
debate.
Yeah.
I wonder if he had access to this.
To Josephus, no. Josephus did have, you know, as Richard Kalman has written, there's some indication that rabbis in Sasanian Babylonia may have had access to Josephus, to translations of Josephus, snippets of Josephus, epitomes of Josephus. We know the Christians in Syriac, Christians were reading Josephus, and we have Josephus in Syriac. You know, so there is some evidence. There's a medieval Josipon, not based directly on Josephus, but based indirectly on a Latin bolderization of, you know, it's a complicated situation. I don't believe Maimonides would have had access to that. Most of the theologizing isn't there, not in quite the same way. No. I mean, but what you have for Maimonides, right, is the re-impact of Greek philosophical thought on these things. So it's not that Josephus, you don't need to read Josephus to deal with, to get a handle on the basic issues of the fate free will problem. By the way, you know, the fate free will problem is always the same whenever it's dealt with. There only are three options, right? That's it, right? I mean, you have different ways of framing the middle option. You have lots of people think the middle option is nonsense, right? Or a paradox, which is sort of another way of saying nonsense, I guess. Right, if you agree with it, it's a paradox, and if you think it doesn't make sense, then you, right? So it's that. It's that, you know, so, you know, Maimonides is having Aristotle in particular, but also other aspects of Greek thought, you know, maybe some of the, you know, I don't know the history of which Stoic philosophers were being read in the early Middle Ages or something like that. Yeah?
Is there, in the thinking of this time, is there any differentiation between the idea of providence operating on a global historical level versus operating or not operating on an individual personal level?
I ask good questions here.
Yeah, you've noticed, huh?
Yeah.
What happens when they come to
change? Tired. All right. Good. All right. This is fun. You know, there's not enough acknowledgement of this, and this is right. That is to say, when I teach, I don't know if anyone's used these words in print, but some of the times when I teach, I try to differentiate, and I haven't used them in print yet either, but I, you know, sort of like micro-theodicy from macro-theodicy, right? And it is, it's different, right? Because people can have, say, certain things about how it's going to work out for the group or for everybody, and very different things about how the individual works out, right? In many ways, so when the rabbis are thinking about the group level, for instance, they're willing to acknowledge that, well, it may not work out for, you know, whatever. But, like, when they're focused on the individual, they really want it to work out for that person, right? Or God is testing or whatever, right? It's got to make sense. But I don't know of any really clear way of laying this out. It's really a problem for fate. Right, but certainly fate is used in very different ways. Right, I mean, people. Right, Josephus is speaking, I think, here. Well, certainly in Antiquities 10, he really means fate in this very general sense of what's happening to the people in this communal sense. And I think that's what he means when he's talking about Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes. Right, and he uses human affairs. Right, although free choice is very individual. So I guess my answer is yes and no. Right. There are, right, one would have to go through and really parse this out carefully. For in most cases, though, right, in the philosophical positions, it's really got to be the same. Right, a philosophical view isn't going to say fate for the group, but not for the individual. Right. Actually, because anyone who believes fate for the group is also going to believe fate for the individual. Right. Because if you believe in fate, then, you know, who cares about the people it doesn't work out for, right? Just too bad for them, right? But that being said, it's actually, you know, in the Stoic philosophical debates, most of them are really focused on the individual decision. Like, they're really thinking about the person. And, like, the classic example of Stoic compatibilism, right, is you take a dog and you tie it to a cart. And then you get in the thing and you whip the horse, and the horse goes, and the cart goes, and the dog goes. And the dog's choice is to either be dragged or walk. Right? That's not much of a choice, right? But at least it's something, right? But that's very individual, and that's one of the classic examples. So, yeah. Over here? Do I get to do this, or are they going to get mad at me if I pick on them?
No, you pick.
Okay, in the blue?
For just
and then,
another couple,
okay.
Because we're for the
yeah,
dog
yeah.
time.
Me?
Yeah.
The Sadduce rejection of the soul in the afterlife apparently is due to their rejection of the concept that God gets involved in reward and punishment, and therefore there's no need for heaven and hell. But are there any strains of theological thought in which the soul can persist in afterlife without invoking heaven and hell?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. Obviously, I didn't say anything about heaven. The Sadducees do believe in judgment, that God removes himself from evil, but he says, the Sadducees then say, you know, we ourselves suffer our own misfortune as a result of our free choice, right? And I think in that sense, Josephus, the Sadducees really are echoing all sorts of tropes from the wisdom tradition and various things from Proverbs, like you reap what you sow, which isn't there, but you know, that kind of a logic, right? You know, that you know, what you put in is what you're going to get out. And I think they're heavily invested in that kind of a thought. As for afterlife, right, I would think the Sadducees actually believe in Sheol. Josephus says that the way he describes the Sadducean belief is that the body and soul perish together and go to the perish together. I would think the Sadducees are non-dualistic in that respect. So that doesn't necessarily mean that there's no afterlife at all, but probably it's just not an afterlife that you'd want, right? It's like being stuck down in the ground, you know, semi-sentient, you know, like Sheol, like when Samuel comes up from Sheol and he's all upset about it, right? And he says to Saul, tomorrow you're going to be with me, right? Right? Everybody's there. It's nothing, you know, the place of the worms. You know, that's how it's described throughout Ben Sira. That's probably what the Sadducees believe, right? They were scripturalists, right? They probably would have believed what scripture has hinted at. It's just not an afterlife where you'd want. It's not where justice works out. The Sadducees believed in, I think, earthly justice, just like most of the Hebrew Bible does.
Sheol is very easy to explain to New Yorkers. You just say Lincoln Tunnel during rush hour. Why don't we take a last question?
Joel.
First of all, I have to say, on a personal note, it is such a pleasure having been your classmate in college to see you.
Sorry, that was not a plant, but I had to call.
All right, so.
Yeah, we took Roman history together.
You did better there than I did. Anyway, so this is moving away from Josephus and more generally to the question of theology at the time of the destruction. So I am assuming that what I have been taught is still regarded true by the scholars, which is that the destruction that the Romans brought was particularly awful, not just at the temple or even in the city of Jerusalem, but a massive, terrible slaughter in Judea generally. So I'm starting there because, and I think that my question is related to the question you were asking, are the theologies that help explain God's destruction of the temple, which after all, as God's seat, more or less, within the community, is no longer worthy of God if we, the Jewish people, are violating the covenant, that a theological explanation for the destruction of the temple is perfectly reasonable. Maybe,
yeah.
You know, it makes good sense. But do those theologies accommodate the level of personal catastrophe going on in society at large? Is there any, do the sources you're bringing treat that difference?
So part of what's interesting here, I mean, Josephus is the one who really describes all the slaughter and all of that. You know, he's into it. The Roman readers are into it. You know, they like blood. Maybe not as much as some of these television shows, I guess. Not that I watch television, but...
You've heard of it.
I've heard of it, yeah. My students talk about it. Although they watch on computers, but I digress. The rabbis, you know, when they talk about it, they're talking about the destruction of the temple. Right? I mean, they're aware of what goes on. It's in there in Gittin, you know, and the people starving to death and cannibalism. Although whether it's, you know, whether that's really coming from history or just reifying Echa, Lamentations, you know, one wonders. So, I guess I would say this. you know, the ancients, I mean, they're responding to the catastrophe as a whole, but they're sort of focused, the trauma in many ways, or the seeming trauma is this destruction of the temple, or the lack of it being rebuilt. But in many ways, part of what I'm saying is that a lot of this language is just... Right? I mean, if we're talking about mass death, that happened at other times in Jewish history, right? The Maccabean conflict, right? You could read Second Maccabees and all the, you know, or even First Maccabees, right? Where the Greeks, like, kill all the people who won't fight on Sabbath, right? And then the Maccabees decide, oh, that's not smart, right? So maybe we'll fight on Sabbath, right? You know, and it's told that way, right? And it's obviously, I mean, these are terrible tragedies for, but you know, and then for the most part, they move on. I don't, you know, put it this way. I'm not aware of really anything in antiquity that is as taken with this as we are.
Right, so again, it's the retrojection of the Holocaust, of a post-Holocaust mindset onto that.
I think so. I think so. I think there's a lot of that.
Right.
Thank you all very much for coming. Thank you, Professor Klontz, for a wonderful and fascinating presentation. Those of you who are interested in buying a volume, please do come up and do that, and you can, you know, have short final conversations as you're doing that. Please come. We've got another couple of book talks coming this year. The one we don't have a date for yet, but it's a very important talk, is we will be celebrating a Festschrift that is being published to honor our dear, esteemed friend and colleague, Professor Neil Gilman, who has not been well, but actually at this moment seems to be better, and we have an opportunity to celebrate the publication of that book with him. So look for the announcement of that. And please come back for that occasion. Good night. Hey, and who are you?
Matt Goldstone. I'm doing my PhD at NYU.
Oh, great.
Sit down. That way you'll be able to sell books.
Oh, sure.